You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the RSA. I am Sam Smethers. I'm Chief Executive of the Fawcett Society. We're a national charity campaigning for women's rights and gender equality, been going for 150 years. Our guest speaker tonight probably needs very little introduction, so I'll just run her through her CV. When I was asked to do this, I just was so thrilled to be asked to chair this evening because, you know, Catherine MacKinnon is an absolute legend, I think, in feminist circles. She's one of the world's foremost scholars and activists on gender equality issues. She's among the most widely cited legal scholars in the English language and certainly the most widely cited woman. She's serving as the first special gender advisor to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, The Hague, from 2008 to 2012, and helped implement her concept of gender crime. She pioneered the legal claim for sexual harassment and, with Andrea Dworkin, created ordinances recognising pornography as a civil rights violation and proposed the Swedish model for abolishing prostitution, a model which has been rolled out in a number of countries around the world. And the Supreme Court of Canada has largely accepted her approaches to equality, pornography and hate speech, which has been influential internationally as well. So I'm going to hand over to Catherine now, and I really look forward to hearing everything you've got to say. Thank you.
This idea of butterfly politics, the title of this book, is an activist concept. I have done a lot of theory in law, and I've done a lot of legal practice. But what I haven't done is theorized my legal practice before. So that's what this is, and this is for all of you who do the engagement that I'm going to be talking about here. What it means, this idea of butterfly politics, is that the right small simple intervention into an unstable political system can ultimately produce large, complex, system-wide changes. It's really a strategic idea about law, about how to go in, where to go in, when to go in. It's how sometimes one case or one word in legislation can produce a major social transformation. The concept came out of my 40 years of law practice challenging sex inequality, which, by the way, I'm still doing. I don't mean this to be a past tense at all. And sex inequality is, as I see it, an unstable system because it is based on the lie that women are inferior to men. And what I've done is gone specifically after what I see to be the crucial juncture in sex inequality, and that is sexual abuse. So in 1972, the scientist Conlett Rad-Lorenz asked the question, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? When he answered yes, he conceived of what has come to be called the butterfly effect, in which what it is a kind of charming model that some properly targeted, extremely small actions, like the butterfly wing, can eventually have very large effects that can be difficult to foresee or predict. The idea then became central to a much larger theory called chaos theory, which is not about things being chaotic. It's about things being either irregular or extremely complex, or the causality turning back in on itself in ways that is hard to predict or foresee. And it's used these days, for example, to predict the weather. And it's one of the reasons that weather prediction is better these days than it used to be. So it produces a series of, you know, the following alternative models could play out. And that's partly why sometimes you see weather predicted as, you know, it could be like this, but the range of possibilities are as follows. So chaos, as I say, doesn't mean lack of pattern. It doesn't mean disorder, only that the patterns are not immediately clear, that they aren't linear. The causality is complex, it's interactive, and it's repetitive, which to me sounds a lot like law and society. And since society, our societies, have changed the weather, actually, more than law has changed male dominance, there's a certain symmetry in all of this. Male dominance, you know, being my domain, the domain of this work. So in this new book, the butterfly idea is the metaphorical framework that is used to organize my mostly unpublished activist speeches and writings into butterfly moments, as I call them, and their unfolding aftermath. So what you have in the book is really the first time a whole set of different ideas showed their face in public. Somebody taped them. And then they're followed by, in the book, by reflections on what is a collective process of take-up and repetition through law, politics, policy, society, that has established each area or at least set it in motion. And some of these ideas, I'll talk about them, are established or at least pretty familiar. A lot of them are just in the process of happening. Some are at a complete standstill, but something may be building underneath. So I'll talk about those different stages in which, you know, the in which the butterfly's wing effects are happening. So among the things that I've learned in this practice and in thinking about it in retrospect in terms of butterfly politics is, and by politics I mean to refer to a structure of power, is that changing the power structure involved, and in my work, as I said, it's male dominance, and I've focused specifically on sexual harassment, on rape in and out of genocide, on pornography and on prostitution, and an emerging theory from all of that of what is now being called, and I've called, substantive equality, which is a different approach to equality than the standard legal approach. The things I've learned is that this project is a collective one. It is not in any way an individual one. It takes a movement. I mean, this isn't news, obviously, but it is bears saying. Also, it is deeply contextual and grounded, meaning it's not isolated in its setting, and it springs from the realities of social life and relationships within social life. In this instance, from, first of all, obviously, you know, women and men in their relationships in society, but also most directly from the people I work with and for, who are both my colleagues, my clients, my inspiration. That is, it comes from them. It's already exists, as I think of it, sort of out there on the hoof, you know, running around in life. And it's just a matter of somebody being awake enough, listening enough to take it in and take it on and take it seriously enough to actually act on it. In other words, it doesn't come from any individuals springing full-blown, you know, from their head. See now the critique of, you know, individual male genius. You know, this is not the way it occurs. Okay, in addition, it is totally contingent, especially because it confronts power as power is organized in the legal setting, and the law itself, obviously, is organized. The law is a form of power that that power organizes. Okay, and so what it means to say it's contingent means it could go either way at any point. It is, in other words, nothing I've done is inevitable. You know, once you do something, people act like, oh yeah, that had to happen because of that. Well, hey, they weren't there, so they don't know that there was nothing that had to happen about it. Okay, so I'm saying it's completely contingent. It is not inevitable. This is, by the way, more or less a left theory, political left theory, that if it's possible, it must have been necessary and impelled, you know. And or It's impossible. And this, of course, is the right's idea, the political right, or at least how they imagine it or what they hope is the case, that the things that we're trying to do are impossible. And I'm saying neither of those is the case. It's actually contingent. And it really does matter what you do. Okay? Having done these things, I just have to tell you, what you do really does matter. Okay? And finally, everything about these changes is content-based, by which I mean it is substantive. It is not abstract. Equality is not an abstraction. It is a substantive reality. Hard to find, hard to see, hard to know, hard to get, but it's got real content. You know, it isn't a thing that floats up in the air. Inequality, similarly, is not an abstraction first. It's a reality first. And then people think about it and make it into an abstraction. So what I'm saying here is that everything depends on making the right intervention, however small. And all of what makes the intervention right is a factor of all of these things that I've just said I learned. Now, some examples are pretty well established. Sexual harassment law, for example, in employment and education, which originally were I thought up, is a clear instance of it. It's an area that also illustrates especially well one dimension of chaos theory, its notion of sensitivity to initial conditions. What these fancy words mean is you have to set things up right in the first place, or the missteps that you make can have consequences that are as big as the right consequences can be when you did it right in the first place. See here, climate change, right? We did it wrong in a lot of ways, and the missteps have gotten huge over time. It, hence the weather. Now, sexual harassment as a practice, according to me, happens because of the sex of the victim and the perpetrator in a culture that encourages and permits sexual predation by dominant groups on subordinate ones. In substance, that is, in content, it is a form of gender-based discrimination. Whoever it is doing what to whoever they are doing it to. And by the way, it has also just recently become part of the recognition that discrimination against gay men and lesbian women is sex discrimination. This happened like 2 weeks ago in a really amazing authoritative way in the U.S. So before this, sexual abuse had never been conceived as part of sex inequality. But doing so in law, because it actually is a practice of sex inequality in life, has had a massive systemic effect, politically and legally, all around the world. And we can talk about the details in our conversation. But most countries have this law. It's internationally recognized, although certainly it needs to be implemented better, and it needs better public comprehension, but I think actually the public comprehension is better than the implementation legally. In the collective hands and heads of survivors and activists and lawyers, it really is working systemic transformations, beginning in the most crucial place, and that is with individual victims recognizing that they have been victimized in violation of their human rights. That is, that they are not alone, that this sexual harassment is not just life. Now, a similar set of effects can be traced in the concept of rape as torture internationally, and also in substantive equality, beginning in Canada, now worldwide. And again, we can talk about those in more depth, but most vividly we can see the recognition of rape in genocide that first emerged when my clients and I litigated our U.S. case under international law against Radovan Karadzic, the Serbian fascist leader, after which the notion that rape could be a weapon in genocide, a weapon of a genocide, was recognized by the International Tribunal for Rwanda, the one for Yugoslavia, and then by the International Criminal Court. Now, the victims knew that their rapes were genocidal. I actually think that the victims in many prior genocides of sexual assault that is instrumental in their genocides have known this too. But the law of genocide didn't before this. The idea emerged directly from the context of their experiences. So all these butterfly moments are deeply imprinted by the realities of the women whose lives produced them. But this concept in particular carries forward the experience of my clients from Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Croatia in that Serbian-led genocide. And it is imprinted by their determination to call their violation what it actually was and to fight it on the terms on which it was imposed on them. So if these changes are largely accomplished, and a lot they are, there are some changes initiated in these interventions that are in an ongoing process of being progressively achieved. One of them is the Nordic model on prostitution, which penalizes the buyers and sellers, that is, the pimps and traffickers of sex, and eliminates any penalties for the sold, the prostituted people. It was first proposed in Sweden, by me actually, in 1990, passed by the unrelenting work of Swedish women over a decade, so that was 1999. It has now reduced sex trafficking there to nearly nothing, and prostitution itself has declined in massive percentiles, while prostituted people who want to leave prostitution are receiving at least some support, which, again, could be better. It's also been passed in, to see the butterfly move here, Norway, Iceland, Northern Ireland, largely in Canada, recently in France, and most recently in the Republic of Ireland. This is in spite of and over the entrenched and well-funded, extremely well-funded, opposition by the international pro-pimp lobby, a.k.a. the sex industry. Now, like all this work, it's directly based, the Nordic model, on the experiences and needs of survivors. Actually, it emerged directly from their lives and experiences and is now a worldwide movement. Now, some of these undertakings, such as were begun, and this includes particularly the pornography work, remain embattled in a glacial state of near stasis, even if one senses tectonic shifts potentially happening gathering down deep. What this shows is the contingency aspect of this theory, which is especially strong when you're up against concerted power, as the sex industry is. That is, they are powerful, rich, well-fronted by legitimate fronts, and violent when necessary, and also when they have legal cover, as they do with pornography, in which the abusive acts are hidden behind what especially in the United States is called speech, end quote, very much like the legal concept of property once hid the slave trade. In the pornography work, beginning in 1983, civil claims for the direct provable harms of sex discrimination done by pornography were proposed, along with an accurate definition. So that's its wing flap, 1983. And the first time I ever said that has never been published before until this book. And so there it is, and it's in there. The harms of pornography have been even more powerfully documented by researchers since that time, and especially given that nothing effective has been done to stop the pornography industry since then, everything in the work from the 1980s forward turns out to be even more true if you read it in the present. And this is especially the case about the silencing of the people who are victimized by the pornography and its harms, a silencing typically justified still in the name of expression. So one place the butterfly effect is just beginning, arguably, is the law of rape. Domestic laws of rape, and this is especially true in the UK, indeed, this may have been something of a UK invention, I'm not absolutely sure, but In any case, it is UK law at this point, and every place that the UK has ever colonized still largely has this concept central to their rape law, and that is the concept, including the US, and that is the concept of consent. Now, while the internet, at the same time, the international definition of rape that has emerged in the ad hoc tribunals, for example, particularly in the Rwanda tribunal, is based on coercion. The concept of consent is so irrelevant in a context of coercion, in circumstances of coercion, that it isn't even mentioned. So making consent central to rape law puts the victim on trial. It is why she is on trial in rape cases. It is rooted in the active-passive model of sex as something someone with more power does to someone with less power, the one who consents or doesn't. It is highly sex-stereotyped, and it is part of the whole political theory that justifies rulers in ruling the ruled. I mean, if you look in big-deal political theory, what you see is how do we justify these governments? The quote-unquote consent of the governed. How do we consent to be governed? First, we're silent. Sound familiar? Second, we're still here. We haven't left yet. Is that familiar to anybody? Third, we're apparently getting all the benefits of this, of which are highly included, like breathing the air and things of this sort. Now, look, if no one's listening to you, if anything, you know, silence could be dissent for all they know, but no, it is consent. I mean, all of it's this scheme where power imposing it on people with less power, when then one acquiesces in it because you have no real options, it's called consent. Okay. Now, it's basically, it means acquiescence. It means being rolled over by power. And it's intrinsically unequal, even when it works as it's supposed to work. It's unequal. Now, in a context of, say, vulnerability or abuse of power, the irrelevance of consent is recognized in the international law of sex trafficking and has been since at least 1949. So there you've got a whole series of forced sex acts in which it is recognized that if varieties of force and inequality, including vulnerability and abuse of power, this is a quote from international law, are creating the context, consent, it says in the next paragraph, shall be irrelevant. So now we're building a whole law about prostitution that understands the irrelevance of consent to serial rape, while we're still trying to redeem consent with like 15 new words we stick on the front of it to make it look like anything like freedom. You know, is it free? Is it voluntary? Was it affirmatively permitted? Was it, I mean, all these words are stacked up in front of the word consent to try to make it mean anything at all other than just lying there, staring at the ceiling, thinking of England. You know, we do this in the U.S., we think of England. I don't know if you think of England here, but, you know, it, or you're Jane Fonda and Clute Quick checking her watch. You should really watch that. It's a really brilliant scene if you haven't seen it. It's all about how into it prostitutes are. So, okay. So, arguably, domestic laws of rape need to, I think, get rid of this consent idea, as international law has, and as international law of sex trafficking has, and reconfigure for non-recognized conflict situations. We're not supposed to be in a conflict, okay? So we can't say this is a conflict, but okay. What is it, pre-conflict, post-conflict? You know, anyway, this is not a conflict, so we need to build things in, you know, to non-recognized conflict settings. And what I think we need to do is reconfigure the definition of force in order to extend beyond physical force, which is the unique obsession of the law of rape. Only physical force typically tends to count in the law of rape, so that all the forms of inequality that actually make force be what it is, race, class, immigration status, age, sexual orientation, inequalities that are hierarchically arranged in society, build those definitions in to the understanding of what makes for force and gender stereotypes when they are deployed to get the drop on somebody. And that would be what rape then would be defined as. Now, connected to all this is the continued virtually near total impunity for sexual abuse of children, which I think arguably is the foundational practice of the whole gender system. Sexual abuse in childhood, I think, is ground zero of sex inequality. It's the foundational dynamic of sexual harassment. It's the same thing. It's the foundation of prostitution and sex trafficking. That is, most people used in prostitution having been sexually abused as children, and they enter prostitution as children. It is about what rape is about, that is, forcing sex on those who have less power than you do. And also, many, if not most, rapists were sexually abused as children. It is also precisely what is sexualized in pornography. It sexualizes the powerlessness of the people on whom the sex is being imposed. And then we're told this is sex in the raw. This is just sex. This is what sex really looks like. You know, and our question is, okay, what sex is it? All right, it's the sexuality of inequality. It's sexualizing inequality per se. And it begins with children in life. And so to escape all this being done to them, many men who are sexually abused as children become masculine. In other words, sexualizing power over others. If you thought you had an option, and your only option was to have this done to you again or to do it to other people, what would you choose? Okay, masculinity gives men that option. With women, to survive under this system, we are all taught to acquiesce in femininity. We sexualize power over us. This is also the consent bit, right? And sexual abuse in childhood, I think, explains more about male violence, meaning violence, and more about sexual politics, meaning politics, than any other single thing does. And although there have been some important steps made against it, and some going after some institutions, for example, churches, residential schools, and so on, and this is important, really virtually nothing is being done about the intimate level of this on the numbers. For example, in the United States, if you read all the studies together, you've got about half of girls in the United States being sexually violated in contact forms before the age of majority. That's a huge number of people. And you know, it sets the floor for everything else that is happening here. And virtually nothing is being done about it, despite the fact there are laws against it. You know, Blackstone said, and this is particularly in reference to rape, but in general, better 10 perpetrators go free than one innocent accused suffer, as if these were alternatives. Okay, with sexual assault, we really have both. You know, systems seem better at convicting people who didn't do it, and they certainly are letting off the hook. His percentages were way low in the number, in his 10 to 1 numbers, of the number of free perpetrators who are out there. I mean, there are now studies of unreported rapists, for example, of them, not just unreported rapes, you know. And so the numbers are way low. Now, the legal approach to this problem that would, I think, constitute its butterfly moment, I believe, hasn't happened yet. So if you think, you know, that all of this is all in progress and, you know, mainly it's pornography, but we need to do something about some of the rest of this, but it's kind of just a cleanup, follow-up operation, think again. This one needs to get started. The code on this one has not been cracked, I think. although really important beginnings have been made by very determined people. But a lot of work needs to be done, from the intimate to the institutional to the structural, on this. Now, since law is an instrument of power, a project of changing it for people without power is resisted. Put another way, law resists changing the definition and distribution of social power, being that it is an instrument and product of its distribution. But this means that a lot of thinking on the relation of law to social change takes the view that the more basic the change, the more the legal system will resist making it. And that's back to if it happens, it must have been inevitable, it must have been allowed, and if it doesn't, it can't be done. Now, there's some truth in this, but I really have found it to be a very limited truth. The legal system may not resist some changes that we're looking for because it doesn't know that they're basic to women, not having given women much conscious, systematic thought. I mean, until we did, who did? Law may not resist some of these needed changes out of institutionalized hubris, tending to regard women as trivial and beneath notice, a kind of noblesse oblige. Okay, honey, we can throw you this bone. You know, everything will be fine. They not knowing how crucial something may be. Or those who control law often, I think, reflexively think that whatever law says, that the real social rules to the contrary will prevail anyway. For instance, with sexual harassment. The real rule with sexual abuse is the more power the abuser has, the more they can do whatever they want. And whatever the law says, and nothing will happen to them. And what I think about this one is, sometimes that's true, but don't count on it anymore. Or an initiative will win for women because there is something in it for men, as in my view is the case with abortion. Overwhelmingly, legal systems may not have arranged themselves to keep women down because they simply haven't needed to. Social systems accomplish this very effectively already. So it isn't even in law yet. Now, all of this is where a real theory of strategic litigation of these butterfly politics begins. And all of this actually provides real openings that, you know, we are available to be taken advantage of. So what I learned from practicing law in the butterfly mode is that it is not that law changes society because of the power it has or because it is a form of force. Rather, it changes society when it does because of what law means to people, including those few violated people who report their sexual violations. That is, the unequal who still believe enough in the law to seek their equality through it. To them, law means community. It means your people stand with you. They hear you. They support you. It means reality. It means what you say happened, happened. It means your knowledge is valid. It means vindication. That is, it is wrong that you were wronged in this way. That someone took something from you that belongs to you. And you count enough for this system to attempt to give it back. It means hope. It means what happened to you might not happen to someone else again, or maybe not to you again. Now, that law is invested with this kind of meaning, not that it can provide closure, because actually it can't, and not that it can order incarcerations, because even if it's necessary sometimes, that really does so little right and so much wrong. Actually, what happens when you get incarcerated, among the many things, is you get raped. We are against that. And it also isn't that it provides money damages, however deserved they are, because no amount can fully compensate. Law can't bring back a murdered child. It can't unrape a woman, a girl, a man, or a boy. Law's power to change lies in its capacity, which we give it, to restore a piece of the humanity that the victimization took away. It is this chunk of wholeness, this possibility, this hope for it, that lawyers for violated people, whether rightfully vindicated or wrongfully convicted, hold in their hands. Butterfly politics can animate political activism and support equality advocacy toward this kind of legal change. These small actions in a collective context can change systems, both internationally and domestically. It encourages multidimensional political thinking, precise engagement, principled creativity, imagination, instinct, and adaptability. It inspires interventions, even tiny ones. It opens discussion and debate on strategy and substance as part of a disciplined process of transformation toward equality, including equality of the sexes. It envisions and joins hands with old and new forms of organizing. Because in isolation and in image, butterflies are delicate, even fragile. They can be overlooked or reduced to decoration. But in life, their endurance lies in their collectivity. Their power lies in their collective effect. On its life journey, a butterfly can be collected and categorized. It can die for lack of nutrition, or it can be smashed against a windshield. Yet still, we rise everywhere. So I say, equality seekers, spread your wings. You're stronger than you know. And what butterflies can set in motion, sometimes even one, cannot be stopped. Thank you.
Fascinating stuff. I think there's so much in that speech that we could pick up on. I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the pornography industry in particular, because it feels like that's where a lot of this starts, really. And we're seeing particularly that being a big influencer on young people and children in schools. You know, that's where they're getting their sex education from, for example. Yet some, we sort of singularly failed to regulate this industry. And, you know, we were having a chat before we came out here and we were talking about, well, look at the tobacco industry. And is there a parallel there, you know, how we've managed to really address the evils that that industry has caused, and yet we've just not done it with pornography. So why have we failed and what do we do about it?
Well, there certainly is a parallel in that, many parallels, in that the tobacco industry lied about the research they had on the harms that were caused. And there's also still endless discussion about causality, you know, and the relation between smoking and all the health effects. And, you know, people who are precise about it scientifically say, yeah, but we still don't really know, you know, but anybody with any sense looks at the figures and, you know, looks at what smoking does to the lungs and to the rest of the body and draws their own conclusions, you know, about their own health. Some of the data on tobacco, on smoking and the harms that it does suggests that as bad as the harms are for the person who's smoking, secondhand smoke is at least as bad, if not worse. And that certainly is the case for this, because for the pornography, because, first of all, the data on pornography is easily 10 times stronger than the data on smoking and all its health effects ever has been. It is, and it gets better by the minute. The scholars have not stopped studying this stuff and its effects on the consumer and on the people around the consumer. And, you know, what they've, and all sorts of new disciplines have discovered that, I mean, pornography is great to study because stuff moves, you know, and if you're looking to study psychological effects or a lot of people who are interested in communications want to study pornography because you can get big results. Well, what does that mean? You know, it means that the results are huge. They're major and highly measurable. But now these days, the neuroscientists have got on the case and started studying the effects of the consumption of pornography on the brain. And they're discovering, what they describe is precisely what we've been saying since the 80s is the consequence of the consumption on the first consumer, which is habituation, a desensitization, but in particular, being desensitized to human pain, to needing more and more violent materials to produce the same level of arousal. They're tracking all this stuff happening in the brain because it's dramatic and it can be found. It's similar in that way, and the pornography industry and the mainstream media, who for some reason thinks they do pornography, even though they don't. And so they want to defend the pornography industry, which makes it hard to get any real information out. They continue to say that the data on the harmful effects is divided. Some show yes, some show no. Well, there isn't any data that shows there is no harm. There's some data that shows that, by very well-paid people, that shows different kinds of effects in addition, but there is no data that says that the harm doesn't happen, that the harm isn't harmful. None of that. Okay, so, but then the secondhand smoke effect is really, one can care about the original consumer. You can care about, the equality of his relationships. Generally, it's a man, but not always. You can care about his habituation to abuse and what that does, to him psychologically. You can care about, things people care about, like his immortal soul or whatever all. The people that I've principally been working with are the people around him who he's harming as a direct result of this. And, it includes, a deeply misogynistic way of relating to women. That as in women are not real, that women are sexual things, that women are objectified, this is creating the water that we fish are living in. It isn't isolated the way secondhand smoke is. It's culturally pervasive. And so what it means, for example, is, as there is now even more pornography than there was when we started doing this work, because, as I say, nothing's being done about it, that means that the whole population is being desensitized on a whole, especially men who have more money than women, on a whole level, so that in order to appeal to them, to get them to do something like spend their money, that advertising and other very mainstream, very above ground, very out there materials have to be increasingly appealing to these people who are being put to sleep by more and more and more violent assaults on women in the pornography that they are increasingly easily consuming on the internet. So it just shifts. People wonder, where does a rape culture come from? Well, I'm here to tell you, we know where it comes from, and how it is maintained. And why it isn't seen as being rape,
You talk about the internet, and I just wondered, given the scale of the challenge with harassment, misogyny online, and, right. all this pornography through all those platforms that, are prolific and making so much money out of it in some cases, what more should we be doing to require them to take action? Should we be regulating them, the Facebooks and the Twitters of this world? What should we be doing to deal with this problem?
Well, I think something has to be done about the pornography industry. It is the engine of all this. It is the main form of sex education that everyone's getting. It's the notion, it's where people go to try to find out what sex is, as if, fumbling around with your best friend isn't good enough. Probably the most equal sex you'll ever have in your life, but you sort of got to see how to do it. This is so weird. It's the only, I don't know if people still think this, but at least people my age were always trying to be normal. They wanted to be normal. And, other In other areas of life, people want to be distinctive. They want to, you know, be special. They want to have something that is uniquely their own. But here, oh my God, you know, we've got to find out how to do it, you know, as if there is a to-do and an it, you know? And that and people go to pornography for this, and without realizing what it's doing to them, you know. I'm waiting for men to really resent. I probably will die without this wish being satisfied, but I'm waiting for men to resent being manipulated by these pimps. That's what's happened. You know, it's made it into what they, at least those who have consumed it, think of as my sexuality, their own. Because it's designed to manipulate the body so that you have an automatic reaction and response to it. And once your body does that response, then you think it's yours.
On that note, should we open it up for questions? Come on, is there a man in the room who wants to ask us a question?
Hi, thanks very much. I had a question about prostitution, because it seems to me in the UK, I mean, it's really, like, in terms of how it's presented on BBC, for example, the BBC is almost a kind of platform to normalise the idea of prostitution and to show examples of sex workers who are kind of happy and confident and loving what they do. And there seems to be very, very little voice in the UK that kind of actually says, no, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Because as far as I can see, there seems to be a thing which is going on, which is pushing towards legalization of prostitution. And I mean, I'm from my perspective, I have a sister who's an employment lawyer, and I know that for her, a lot of her clients are people who've been trafficked to do domestic work. So I can see domestic work is something that anyone can do. It's not frowned upon. It's not you're not criminalised for it. And so there's always this thing which says, well, you know, criminalising it pushes it underground, makes people more vulnerable. And I find it very hard to find many people to discuss this, or in mainstream media's many fronts where this might be kind of spoken about a bit more.
Yeah, well, you came to the right place. The domestic work that people do often includes a lot of sexual abuse. So, and a lot of people come to a country like this from another country to do domestic work and, you know, find themselves being sexually violated as part of what they're expected to sustain. And sometimes, you know, when they run away from that, then find there's no place to run to except pimps and so on, and then, you know, become, so they're, in essence, initially, however they got into the original gendered workplace, which already is about foreclosed options for women. In other words, mostly it's women doing domestic work, mostly it's women who are at the bottom of the immigration scale. Even though life is not good for men in those positions, mostly they're not doing domestic work, if you see what I'm saying. So sex discrimination, you know, keeps putting women in lower categories of whatever it is we're talking about. And then they end up in the sex industry. So, yeah, the push in the UK right now, but also the long-term policy of the sex industry is to decriminalize prostitution. And the reason they want to do that is because they make more money that way. The places that they've done it, they're making fortunes, and they traffic women into those places, into those countries, into the legalized brothels. And even though part of the objective of legalization, one of the objectives was to attempt to eliminate trafficking, well, that isn't what happens. It just, the traffickers just organize themselves, you know, to funnel women into the places where once you get them there, it's an endless money-making machine. And so the whole idea of calling prostitution work, as in sex work, suggests that for some women this is a perfectly fine way of making a living. And There also are some men who do it, many fewer, and typically for a much shorter period of time, but there are some. And the research that's been done on this, which is actual research by women who have recently left prostitution, who are the ones who are actually both designing the questions and talking to typically women, but also trans people and some men in prostitution, have learned that, number one, the main reason for being in prostitution is being destitute, is having no options other than this and no other way of making a living. In other words, it is for survival, pure and simple. In a way that if any there were any options, those other options would be taken. The second thing that is found is that around about in the low 90 percentiles, say, if you ask them, what do you most need? The answer is offered spontaneously in various forms to leave prostitution, but I don't know how to get out. In other words, they are pushed in by extreme poverty and kept in by a whole series of dynamics. And again, about 90% of them are pimped. So most of it is being done in an organized way where somebody else is taking the vast percentage of the money and keeping them in it and not allowing them to leave. This is actually the vast majority, not 100%. And so what you have is, I mean, what is generally described as sexual slavery internationally is being in a situation of prostitution that you can't get out of. And as I said, most people who are in it got in it underage, and most of them were sexually abused as children prior to getting into prostitution. That is people in, I'm speaking now in Western countries, overwhelmingly. In other countries, it's organized somewhat differently. For example, in India, where there is a prostitute caste, another brilliant invention by the British, that the girls get in prostitution at age 10 in this caste, and they are gang raped immediately, and then, I mean, they weren't sexually abused prior to that, and then they are making a living for the family. But in general, in the West, it's prior sexual abuse. Then getting into the sex industry, around 13, 14 is the average age, appears to be. But, you know, the age of majority, at least where I'm from, is 18. And so, you know, it's vast amounts enter before then. The rates of rape and abuse, and certainly abuse by the buyers who are buying the right to abuse, that's what they're there. They want to do what they want to do. That's why they're buying her. And that means whatever. And that's also the case in the legalized systems, even though they try to control for that. Does this sound like a job to you? Well, I think you talk, the way you change the conversation is by talking about the realities, which is what I've just been doing. You know, this is not work. You know, this is throwing money after a sexually abused person.
I'm going to take three questions. Man here, and then I'm going to come across over here.
Are you, in fact, arguing that violence and the abuse of power is the real pornography?
Okay, then a question at the back.
I was wondering what your views are in terms of inequality within the legal profession itself, in terms of the disproportionate numbers of, tends to be white, male, privileged men who are not only lawyers but also sit in the judiciary, and what impact that has upon the way in which the law is designed, constructed and enforced. And secondly, in terms of inequality that women experience themselves as lawyers, as judges within the profession. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. So I'm, among other things, a campaigner. I'm working with a group trying to get the UK to ratify the Istanbul Convention. Recently, we made a bit of progress in getting them to pass a law that means that they will set a timetable for ratification and report annually on their progress towards it, which is good but not good enough, so we're going to keep going. And I just wondered if you had any advice or top tips, given that, you know, what you're talking about is, I guess, I hope what we're doing is those small, that little pushing away. So anything that we would do, we could do next.
Brilliant. That's a really fantastic campaign, the I See Change campaign. So good to see them represented here.
A lot has happened with that, actually. I really don't think I would say that violence and abuse of power is the real pornography. I don't use the word. The real pornography is what is being sold as pornography out there right now. That is the real pornography. Now, you know, you're wanting to make a moral critique of it and, you know, use what I've said to do that. I mean, I think that it's, you know, a good expression of indignation that you articulated there. I would just say that, just as a matter of reality, I would want the term pornography to describe what the pornography industry creates, what it does, what it sells, what it pushes, and what its defenders are essentially fronting for and calling, you know, freedom of expression. That's the real pornography already. And it is a form of abuse of power, and it's violent. And it's good that you added abuse of power to violence, because often the abuse of power doesn't look like what people imagine violence is. You know, so I'm... Yes and no with this, pardon? Absolutely, well, especially with children. You don't have to be violent with children. Also, you don't have to be violent, you know, with people that you have a lot of power over, like your employees, like people who, if they don't do what you want sexually, you will send them back to where they came from, given their immigration status, with, you know, people who you can get away with things with, because you know that the power structure, this is to the second question now, won't take seriously their complaints, you know, because of built-in bigotry. Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, that there's any real guarantee that if you have, say, women in positions of power, that all the right things will happen. That isn't true. It so isn't. I mean, but it also, I mean, if you don't have real diversity, you know, if you don't have women of color on your judicial benches, you don't have people who, like, know from life what a lot of these issues are about, the relation of the way the racism is sexualized with the way the racism is racist, you know. So when these experiences come into the court, they shouldn't be, I think, having to talk only to white, largely upper class men. And also in the United States anyway, there's really good studies about the inequalities that women lawyers experience when attempting to practice law. Women of all social descriptions. And I can't speak to those facts on the ground here, but you can, and, you know, your experiences can, and, you know, maybe if those studies haven't been done, it would be helpful to do them, because it's damaging not only to their effectiveness, which is damaging to the lawyers, it's damaging to their clients, and it sets up a dynamic, you know, where people are thinking, well, you know, if this judge is extremely sexist and really isn't going to take her seriously, you know, maybe a man should go and represent this client. And, you know, it just, it continues a cyclic way that the inequality is built into the way the system responds. So.
And the I See Change.
Yeah, I have nothing specific to add to that, because I would need to know more about the concrete content of, you know, exactly where things are and exactly the move that you're trying to make. The only one thing I would say about the Istanbul Convention and in general is that often in discussions of domestic violence, which is its focus, sexual abuse is not placed front and center. And I think it's one of the reasons that the approach to violence against women as in the shape of domestic violence has actually succeeded internationally more than other forms of approaches, other approaches to abuses, because people know they do forced sex at home and they don't want to think of themselves as beating their wives. In other words, there's a very different stigmatic level to the way sexual force is used in intimate relationships than there is to the way physical force, i.e. things men do to other men, are used, even though actually men sexually violate other men as well. So, you know, it's just something to keep in mind, I would say, in order to, you know, continue to both enhance its effectiveness, but also to have it go to the core of the issues, that sometimes the violence itself is sexualized and no one wants to talk about that, and sometimes the sexual violence itself is not discussed. So,
I'm really sorry, I'm going to have to bring it to a close because we're up for time now. Can I urge you to buy Catherine's book? It's out in the foyer. She's very happy to sign copies as well, I'm told, so make the most of that.
I love to sign them because it really is for you, this book, and it allows me to make it be this gift to you when I sign it. So it makes me really happy. People think it's tacky or something. I'm telling you, this is how I relate to it.
And there's one of my favorite bits in it is there's a chapter which is her 10 rules, or her 10 lessons. And the third one is, life is short, go for central issues, go for the jugular. And I thought, yeah, I really, really like that. I really get the sense that's exactly what she's done. So can I give you Catherine McKinnon?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.